Ready to make your money work smarter? Kraken is the crypto platform trusted by over 13 million people worldwide. With Kraken, you can instantly buy and sell crypto, power up your trades with advanced tools, and get 24/7 support from real humans anytime you need help. Kraken has been around for more than 14 years and was voted the best crypto exchange of 2025 by Forbes. Getting started is simple. Create an account, fund it, and place your first trade. Start today at kraken.com.
Kyle Anzalone Show, and I am thrilled today to be having Jim Webb returning to the show. Jim, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thanks for having me, Kyle. I see that I am Dave Smith today. That's okay. I am not as funny as him, but I will try.
I don't know. I think you already got a pretty good joke in there. Way to catch that. I'm sure producer Chris behind the scenes is thrilled he had the wrong one up there. And speaking of producer Chris, you're going to be working with him on a brand new podcast that you are launching next week. I know you have an absolute banger lineup for your first week, Danny Davis, Daryl Cooper. So everybody definitely keep your eye out for that. Be sure to check out Jim's channel, the Jim Webb Podcast, and subscribe because you're not going to want to miss the episodes he has coming up. But I do have a lot of news I want to talk to you about today. A lot of stuff happening in the world that isn't as good news as your upcoming podcast. We have Heads at the Main, the Truth to Congress, Tots at a Standstill, and the U.S. military buildup in the Middle East. Want to start off here with Pete Hegseth. He's been testifying in front of Congress for the past couple days. Maybe they got him sober. He seems a little bit grouchy, and this is what he had to say in an exchange
He's
with a senator.
He's hell-bent on getting a nuclear weapon and get them to a point where they're at the table giving it up in a way that
so they
never have it.
So they haven't broken yet. Okay, we haven't gotten there yet for all of the...
Well, their nuclear facilities have been obliterated. Underground, they're buried, and we're watching them 24-7. So we know where any nuclear material
might be. We're claiming
my
time for just a quick second here. We had to start this war, you just said, 60 days ago, because the nuclear weapon was an imminent threat. Now you're saying that it was completely obliterated?
They had not given up their nuclear ambitions, and they had a conventional shield of thousands of
missiles. So Operation Midnight Hammer accomplished nothing of substance. It left us at exactly the same place we were before. So much so that
their facilities were bombed and obliterated. Their ambitions continued, and they're building a conventional shield of missiles.
Let me try again.
It's the North Korea strategy. You know this very well. The North Korea strategy was use conventional missiles to prevent anybody from challenging them so they could slow walk their way to a weapon. President Trump saw Iran at its weakest moment, took an action to ensure, in a way that only the United States of America could do with our Israeli partners,
and yet
to ensure
they still
their
haven't
conventional
given up the
shield
nuclear.
Was right. was brought
now, one
to
other
deal,
question,
which we've done.
If I could get to it. So on you.
So, Jim, what do you make of that? Pete Hegseth saying that Iran's nuclear program had been obliterated before the war, because I thought the point of the whole war was to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
Well, there's a couple different things, Kyle. First of all, I think we all knew that the Midnight Hammer operation was a success because Donald Trump said it was a success. But he said the quiet part out loud with the ambition still being there. And I still have the ambition to play Major League Baseball. However, my facilities to get that done have been destroyed, courtesy of the Marine Corps, and at my current age. So it's never going to happen. But more seriously here, he said that he really said the quiet part out loud, which is the key part that's keeping us in this conflict is gone. And we've seen all kinds of different things. You know, we've seen it's the objective is regime change. We were going to take out the Ayatollah and we did. which was a very, very irresponsible way, to put it mildly, to start this conflict. And there was going to be some sort of revolution in the streets where people rose up, and it didn't happen. So now we're talking about getting rid of their nuclear ambitions because they have no nuclear program. And before this, it wasn't even ambition. It was the fact that they were capable of enriching uranium up to 60% is where they're at. And that is not something that is, you know, can be turned into a weapon immediately. That's good for programs that would, fuel ships at long distances, nuclear fuel for ships, and also chemotherapy, treatments for cancer. And these are all within the boundaries of the NPT, which they're signatories for. And what we're seeing right now is very clearly that they're grasping at straws for a justification because they never made the case to the American people. And there really isn't a coherent case for what we're doing. And they're severely on their back foot as a result of Hormuz being closed and global oil prices skyrocketing, inflation kind of coming off the rails here at home.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I had always taken Iran's overall strategy with their nuclear program to be to have a completely domestic nuclear energy program so they could sell their oil abroad and generate revenue that way. Mm-hmm. And that's why they want the ability to enrich their own uranium. That way they have the ability to produce their own nuclear fuel and their own nuclear fuel rods and other things they need for their program, as well as, you know, having the medical program, which I'm guessing was more of a cherry on top than the actual strategy revolving around their energy policy. And then they got caught in a little bit of their own trap when they said, okay, since you've carried out this attack against us, this assassination, we're going to go from enriching our uranium at 3.6% to 5%, as the Israelis did more assassinations, more sabotage attacks. They're like, all right, now we got to go a little bit higher. Now we're at 12%. Now we're at 20%. Now they're at 60%. And the Americans are going, well, that's over halfway to a nuclear bomb. So I don't know. Do you think that this was just a negotiating strategy, or I think the administration would present it as like a backdoor secret way to go about getting a nuclear weapon?
I think it's beyond that. You made some great points, Kyle. But terminating the JCPOA was a setup, quite frankly. And there has been very little discussion about two things that I really like to point out. One is the NPT, where there is no restriction on how far you can enrich, just you can't make weapons, and they're a signatory to it, unlike Israel. And the second piece of this is that there's really no case for restricting them in terms of what you're talking about. They have a fatwa on on nuclear weapons. Period. Except that was Khomeini's fatwa, and he is now dead. But the second piece of this, which is the most important piece, I think, is the history that we have with nuclear weapons and counterbalancing the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Mutually assured destruction was our policy for generations, really. And we had thousands of nuclear weapons pointed back and forth, and no one pulled the trigger. And to think that if they can get to 60% or 90% or even make 1, 2, 10, 15 nuclear weapons, that they're going to use them and ensure their country is turned into a sheet of glass is really ludicrous. And it's the ultimate in fear-mongering and scare tactics.
Yeah, and then this is the first time I've heard somebody from the administration say that Iran was trying to go with the North Korea strategy as far as developing a conventional missile shield in order to use that as cover to create a nuclear weapon. I remember history a little bit differently. There was the agreed framework, which was kind of like the Iran nuclear deal. The U.S. broke that and got out of that. Mm-hmm. And then the entire military was bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan. So when North Korea was trying to build a nuclear weapon, there just simply wasn't enough military capability to go fight another war in East Asia. Mm-hmm. So do you think Iran's following the North Korea path, or is there a little bit of a different history there?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say they're not, due to the fact that the North Koreans followed what they have very openly called the Gaddafi or the Libya model, where you had a situation where Muammar Gaddafi thought that if he gave up all of his ambitions for weapons of mass destruction and turned over his chemical weapon stockpiles and got rid of his ballistic missiles, which are, you know, in concept a very, very similar type of strategy that the Iranians have been using to counterbalance conventional American force, that the Libyans would be accepted into the West. You know, if you go back to what George Bush said, he said, you're either with us or you're against us. So Gaddafi said, hey, man, I want to be with us or with you. And that was decent enough for a couple of years. And then what ended up happening to Gaddafi was that he was hoisted literally on his own petard and impaled on a bayonet and killed. And we overthrew his government. His country turned into an absolute disaster with open slave markets. And Kim Jong-un is on the record saying that his nuclear weapons are they're an insurance policy. And with the way that we have treated the Iranians on this, and I'm not saying that, you know, they're ever going to be an ally or I would ever want to live under their system of government, but the way that we have treated them by terminating the Iran nuclear deal and subsequently bombing them and assassinating our way through their country and getting rid of the moderates in the process has probably ensured that at some point they're going to want one just for the fact that it is the natural counterbalance to the ambitions of the United States right now. Because if you take a look at North Korea, we're not doing anything about North Korea right now. And we can't really.
Yeah. And the North Koreans, you know, say it all the time that they will never give up their nuclear weapons because that's, you know, what protects them. And the Libya thing, you know, I've had Professor Joseph Twillinger on the show in the past, and he actually served as Dennis Rodman's translator when he went and met with Kim Jong-un.
I bet that was a trip.
And Joe has said that Kim personally told him that the North Korea was a big issue. I want to move on to this next clip of Pete Hegseth.
The biggest challenge, the biggest adversary we face at this point are the reckless, feckless, and defeatist words of congressional Democrats and some Republicans.
Jim, I feel like I'm back in middle school again hearing this rhetoric that, hey, everybody, if you're not, you know, for our troops, if you're not for this war, that's the reason we're not winning it. What do you make of that concept that it's just not enough patriotism getting us over the finish line here?
Ready to make your money work smarter? Kraken is the crypto platform trusted by over 13 million people worldwide. With Kraken, you can instantly buy and sell crypto, power up your trades with advanced tools, and get 24/7 support from real humans anytime you need help. Kraken has been around for more than 14 years and was voted the best crypto exchange of 2025 by Forbes. Getting started is simple. Create an account, fund it, and place your first trade. Start today at kraken.com.
It's ridiculous. He's grasping at straws. And you can go back even further than just middle school. Those are the words of actually Nazi Germany and communist Russia during World War II. Any talk about how, in particular, Nazi Germany was losing the war against the Soviets was considered defeatism. And it was because they were losing and they had a very, very bad plan out of the gate. But to come into Congress and lecture the people who are supposed to be conducting oversight on what you're doing and controlling how you do it because they're the voice of the people is peak hubris. And I would encourage Congress to actually, you know, take what he said to heart because it's quite literally an insult and to do something about it. They haven't. They've ceded their power on just about every single front. And it's, you know, they are largely to blame for where we are because at any given time, they could have done something about this and they still can, yet they do not.
Absolutely. Jim, I want to move on and talk to you about the negotiating process. It seems to have all but broken down at this point, and this is what Secretary of State Marco Rubio had to say earlier this week.
On Saturday, the president canceled the talks in Islamabad, Pakistan, keeping special envoys Kushner and Witkoff here in the United States. He said just 10 minutes later, the Iranians made a new offer on paper. And it was better.
If what they mean by opening the straits is, yes, the straits are opened as long as you coordinate with Iran, get our permission, or we'll blow you up and you pay us. That's not opening the straits. Those are international waterways. They cannot normalize, nor can we tolerate them trying to normalize a system in which the Iranians decide who gets to use an international waterway and how much you have to pay them to use it.
So, Jim, looking at the situation now, do you see any pathway to the U.S. getting a deal done with Iran?
I do, but I am not bullish on it. So to take apart Rubio's statement a little bit, I think it's very important to remember that the strait was open before we decided to go to war on behalf of Israel. It was not closed. They were not charging a toll. And I've heard time and time again that the Iranians are charging tolls in effect to compensate for war damage inside their country. It's not necessarily reparations. It's, you know, it's a way for them to rebuild a lot of the infrastructure that we've destroyed. So that kind of brings us to where we're at right now. What is the path forward on this? And there are a couple different bits and pieces that are good negotiating, you know, good negotiating pieces, for lack of a better term. But I don't know if the administration has a stomach to do it, because they will have to eat some crow. The number one thing that the Iranians appear to be concerned about is the basing of U.S. troops in the region. And as demonstrated by the attack on Iran, 60 days ago or so, they only exist in that area in order to provide a threat or to remove the Iranian regime or to just straight up attack Iran. We're not at war with Iraq anymore, even though we have troops there and they do come under fire. The entire apparatus is designed to go after Iran, and they want our guys gone. This ties into one of Trump's campaign promises from 2016, from 2020, most recently 2024, which is to end stupid wars in the Middle East and to bring our troops home. And right now he's polling at about 33%, according to the AP. It might actually be lower than that. And he's violated just about every one of his campaign promises. And this was a big one that got myself and a lot of people to vote for him, a lot of independents. And if he were to go about and do that, one, he could actually save some face and perhaps galvanize or light a fire under what remains of his base going into the midterms. And also, it would be a very big concession, in part of a negotiation. And I think it's important to remember that when you're doing international relations, you're not just making a deal. You are, you're having an exchange of ideas, and you concede different points in order to get to an objective, because it's not transactional, it's reciprocal. And this would be a big, big, big move in terms of trying to get a reciprocal deal that would also please his base and, hopefully from his perspective, preserve him a little bit politically.
Yeah, so I've been interested and kind of curious that Iran is so adamant about removing the U.S. military bases in the Middle East, because in the lead up to the war, the U.S. had to empty a lot of them, reposition troops around in order to be able to defend them. And from what we've seen, they've served as little more than targets for Iran to hit and destroy. It almost seems like if the U.S. put troops back in these bases, they're kind of hostages and give Iran a little bit of leverage over the United States. But on the American side, I think we're going to see a lot of pushback here over, well, if the U.S. leaves, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, the Chinese are going to move in. And I think it's very possible that those countries do follow that course of action. But of course, the China hawks in the United States are going to panic, particularly as a lot of these countries do already have advanced American military systems, Patriot missiles, F-35s, other advanced aircraft. So any, I guess, larger, kind of great game concerns over taking that route of removing U.S. troops from the region.
So if you go back, there's a couple of different data points. You hit on a lot of great stuff again, Kyle. If you go back to the great game has been, in effect, a suck on whoever has been involved in it. Going back to the British Empire, nobody who has descended into the quagmire that is the Middle East has come out any better for it. So, my initial comment on if the Chinese move into the Middle East is let them have it. We are supposedly energy independent. We have the capability to be so. We can still trade. We just don't want to be involved in the, intramural firefights, so to speak, that go on in the region. And we have spent trillions upon trillions of dollars there in just the last 25 years. So if removing our bases staunches that kind of bleeding and we get to pass off that burden to the Chinese, let them have it. In my opinion. The second piece of this are all of our weapon systems that are in the region. There might be some pushback from the hawks out there about, they have these systems, they could pass the tech off. Well, we've already exposed our technological, what used to be our technological advantage, both in Ukraine and now throughout this war, whether it's the F-35, whether it's the THAAD, the Patriot, all of these systems have been on display, and any advantage you have is only when you first use these going back throughout the history of combat. You can go back to World War I and take a look at the introduction of, you know, modern artillery and the machine gun. And it was incredibly effective during the first part of the war. Artillery remained effective, but the most deadly part of that war was the opening round. Then everybody adjusted, and you had the next iteration of combat, which was aviation and tanks. And that took over into the Second World War. And then again, there was an adjustment. So that's all to say that our equipment has been exposed and largely been shown to be of moderate effectiveness, or rather ineffective, particularly the anti-aircraft systems. And then the final piece is we have been treating these countries effectively as protectorates for a number of years, saying that if you stand with us against Iran, we'll protect you when the time comes. The time came, and they got mollywopped. And all of our infrastructure, not all of it, but a tremendous amount of it, is already destroyed. So we would be leaving really nothing behind. And it's an opportunity for our own clean break.
Yeah. And look, I'm sure, especially with, you know, our defense industrial base being privatized and China's, you know, we don't talk about China's intelligence a lot, but they are very skilled at corporate espionage. So I guess if they want a lot of this, they just steal it from us. Plus, I do, at least Iran is claiming that they recovered one of our bunker busters that we used in Midnight Hammer and exploded, and that they're working to reverse engineer that. There is a different strategy that some are recommending on how to move forward with Iran. This is retired general, Jack Keane.
Frankly, if we haven't told these leaders who we're negotiating with, if we go back to combat operations, they're going to be held accountable, and their personal survival is going to be target one, then we're missing a boat. I'm sure we have done something like that. What? So that, I think, is a reasonable path, and I'm thinking that's the administration is certainly yesterday's meeting probably was likely all about what to do next. What?
So, Jim, I'm wondering if this is the path we need to go for. Just, you know, we keep killing Iranian leaders until someone reasonable assumes the throne, and at that point we'll make a deal.
No. Also, I would appreciate a trigger warning next time you put that guy on saying something like that. That joke. But no, that's absolutely absurd. We're in this position right now because we took that pathway right out of the gate. And we have killed off any number of moderates. And when you do this, you justify the hardliner's perspective. And it's not just, you know, this, and killing them is the, you know, it's the most extreme way you can do it. We've been on this pathway for a number of years, going back to the maximum pressure campaign designed by Pompeo and the secretary or the Department of State, I believe in 2018, 2019 and forward, where you put a squeeze on the population at that point, and the individuals who are suffering under what we're doing end up you know, looking at people who want to take a harder stance against America and seeing that it's justified. Then you kill off the moderates who want to negotiate, to include the Ayatollah, who may or may not have been the most moderate guy, but he's certainly more moderate than the person who's in charge now. And, you know, you empower the next generation of extreme, extreme guys, and they're not going to want to talk for any number of reasons, to include a blood libel that it now exists, you know, and that exists all throughout society, down to civilians being killed and, you know, the schools we've bombed, particularly the girls' school. And it's very unfortunate that we're at this spot. But what Jack Keane is saying is absolutely outrageous, and I don't know why anybody would listen to him at this point.
And is there something that happens whenever you start adding stars to yourself in the U.S. military that drops your IQ? Because, you know, I hear Jack Keane, Keith Kellogg, Admiral Bradley Cooper is in the White House today pitching Trump on another round of strikes against Iran. And they all seem to have this idea that, you know, we could just bomb Iran whenever we want, and Iran doesn't get a say, right? Like if we kill Iran's leaders and they start wiping out, you know, water infrastructure across the Middle East, or power plants and things like that, you know, these are things that Iran is openly saying that they're going to do in response to the U.S. restarting the war. So why do so many of our top military commanders not seem to understand that there not only are limits on what the U.S. military could do, but Iran gets to respond to what the U.S. does?
Right. The enemy always gets a vote, Kyle. To go back to the first part of your question, I don't think it's something that happens when you put on stars. It's there's an arc to become a general that is highly political. You don't get there by pushing against the grain, particularly, you know, if you have been serving over the last 20 or 25 years. I'm not entirely sure how many of these guys have actually seen combat. Combat burn. I've been in combat. It burns you out. I don't know, a ton of my peers who decided to stay in for the entire duration due to the deployment tempo. There was actually a huge problem early on in the global war on terrorism where they were losing experienced guys in their first enlistment because it is a very, very hard job. And at the same time, once you go to war, you don't particularly like it anymore. There's a very few select guys who will do this over and over and over again. And my hat's off to them. But they're not generals. They are enlisted. They are senior enlisted. They are, you know, they are on the ground and they want to be used in a way that makes sense because they know how tenuous your existence is in that kind of environment. But, you know, the folks who are at the top now, they have gotten there by saying the right things and they are undoubtedly looking, you know, at their next job, which is closer than the start of their career. Most of these guys are getting out in only a couple years and they want to walk over to your major defense contractors and have that cushy gig. And pushing back against the use of those kinds of systems and having an anti-war stance, or what I would just say is a realistic perspective on how things are going and what should be done, is not good for your longevity in that environment at all. So, you know, it's you can probably put another label on it, Kyle, but that's just my perspective.
No, you probably have a better perspective than I could, but it does seem like you're probably right about that. Now, Jim, I got one more thing I want to talk to you about. There's this really, I think, fascinating article in Bloomberg. One of the things that Cooper will be asking for Trump is to send hypersonic missiles to the Middle East. It would be the first deployment of a U.S. hypersonic missile. This is the Dark Eagle missile system. Mm-hmm. Two very interesting things in this article. One, the Pentagon has at most 8 of these missiles. Iran seems like a country of a size where you're probably going to need more than 8. Second, the reason that CENTCOM is requesting these is that Iran has moved their missiles 300 miles or more inland, and now we can no longer strike Iran with our standoff munitions, particularly the PRSM, the Precision Joint Standoff Munitions. Mm-hmm. And so what do you make of this? To me, this seems like actually a signal of a lot of weakness rather than strength.
I'd agree with you. And if we only have 8 and the actual system has not been validated, this just kind of seems like a very real world practical application of a technology that we're still developing. And it's not a signal of strength at all. And you brought up a very important point about the PrSM being out of range. The other problem with that is we have used so many of those that our inventories are very low. And we are, you know, that people are raising the flag and warning that we are not able to respond in other theaters should we need to. Another big indicator of an issue moving all of those systems inland for us is that typically we would expect that the U.S. military is able to go in anywhere and touch where those missiles are. And the need itself to use standoff munitions and then even more advanced standoff munitions is a very bad sign. And it runs completely counter to the president's assertions and Secretary of Defense's assertions over and over again that their military has been basically wiped out. Because if their military had been wiped out, the thing we do first whenever we go into a country, whether it's Iraq or the Middle East, Bosnia back in the 90s, is you take out the anti-aircraft system so that you have the ability to operate from the air, because that is a huge part of our doctrine. And we have yet to be able to establish that very clearly. And they're in essence admitting it. So I would suggest that, we kind of cut our losses where they're at. And the time is now to find a diplomatic resolution for this instead of, you know, attempting to double and triple down and quadruple down, because there's a lot riding on whether or not we have a peace deal and Hormuz opens back up globally.
Yeah, I think you touch on something so important there, Jim. The perception of Americans is that we have an endless supply of bombs. And my guess is if you're talking about, you know, 250, 500, 1,000 pound, 1,500 pound dumb bombs, right? The ones that Israel has been dropping on Gaza, or you equip them with a JDAM kit, you could, you know, drop them precision guided on all these targets. However, to use those, the F-15s, the F-16s, the F-35s have to be generally close to their target, right? Probably right. 150 miles or so.
Oh, closer.
And I think the Ukrainians were able to use like the extended range JDAM kits up to like 200 miles if like they use certain maneuvers as they're launching them. They almost look like drones, the size of the wings on the ER kits. But of course, we've sent a lot of those to the Ukrainians. And so do Americans kind of need to wake up and realize our military has found the limit of what it is capable of doing by conventional means? You know, we could kill Gaddafi, we could kill Saddam, we could bomb the Taliban out of power, but there is a limit to the U.S. military capabilities.
Right. And I mean, I would say it simply this way. We were spoiled by the last 25 years of warfare. And that may sound like it's an odd thing to say, right? But there's a difference between attacking a place like Iraq or bombing Afghanistan, both countries which had really no means of conventional defense, and even something like going to war in the Gulf War in the early 90s or Vietnam. We lost dozens of aircraft over Baghdad in the early 90s. And these are, you know, we were going up against, you know, very baseline conventional systems that were from the Vietnam era. We lost a tremendous amount of aircraft to surface-to-air fire during Vietnam. And this perception of complete and total dominance that came out of the global war on terrorism is because we were, in effect, fighting militias all over the world that had no conventional assets and absolutely no anti-aircraft assets. So now we are squared up against a conventional military that has capabilities, and they're not even, you know, really dominant capabilities like something that, say, the Russians would have or the Chinese would have. There's overlap in the systems, but doctrinally and in terms of what their capabilities actually are, they're not even on that level yet. But this is the reality of warfare. You have all of these types of systems, and you typically have a tremendous amount of overlap in your systems, and not expendable, but easily replaceable, industrial produced type of aircraft and weapons platforms, because you expect to take casualties. That is the nature of war. And America hasn't dealt with that in quite some time. And now we're in a situation where that actually is a reality if we want to impose our will. And the other reality of that is if you want to impose your will, you have to have the political will to do it. And the population has to be willing to take casualties, which means you need a reason to be there, which we don't have.
Absolutely. Jim, before you go, tell everybody about the Jim Webb podcast and your lineup going into next week. Your first week, the first show will be Monday, Star Wars Day. That's May the 4th at noon, right?
Yep, May the 4th, noon Eastern. We're going to have Daryl Cooper of Martyr Maid. He is the first guest, followed by Dan Davis on Cinco de Mayo, Taco Tuesday. We'll see if Trump gives us a gift there. Joe Kent is on May 6th. My dad, former Senator Jim Webb, is on May 7th. And then Friday, closing the first week, is Robert Barnes. And then, of course, I would be remiss in not mentioning that Mr. Kyle Anslin will be joining us on May the 11th. So
I appreciate excited. Me on after that absolute banger of a lineup you got there, Jim. I'm sorry, I'm looking at Chris to wrap up the show here. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in today. Be sure you like and share this episode, and also subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any future episodes. We got Richard Medhurst coming up tomorrow, 4:45 Eastern. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Kyle. Someone throw up?
Ready to make your money work smarter? Kraken is the crypto platform trusted by over 13 million people worldwide. With Kraken, you can instantly buy and sell crypto, power up your trades with advanced tools, and get 24/7 support from real humans anytime you need help. Kraken has been around for more than 14 years and was voted the best crypto exchange of 2025 by Forbes. Getting started is simple. Create an account, fund it, and place your first trade. Start today at kraken.com.